settle down, sorry. Settle down. Okay, I get to introduce tonight's speaker tonight, and we all know he's good looking already. Okay, so Johnny from Santee, take it over.
All okay. Right.
Let's see. Good evening, family. I'm Jonathan. I am an alcoholic. I want to start this evening with a moment of silence. My grand sponsor passed this morning, and you know, he was a man of very stand up ethics and love, and always welcomed the newcomer. And John. Not the John that got me to come up here, but another John. So if we could have a moment of silence for John B. Thank you. So as I think about all the people that came before me, and, you know, reached their hand out to me when I was new, and, you know, the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, it really humbles me to recognize, you know, what this has grown from, right? And we see it on our tokens, you know, quite often you'll see, you know, the animation of what was happening when AA started, and it hasn't changed too much. You know, the book, one of my favorite, you know, things that the book claims is, you know, nothing so much ensures immunity from drinking as intensive work with, you know, other alcoholics. And, you know, a newcomer is going to be the bright spot in our lives, right? And I can promise you I was not a bright spot in too many people's life when I came here. And, you know, if my sponsor and his wife were here, they'd be nodding their heads going, oh, yeah, you were angry. Because I was a victim, you know. I live my life with this victim mentality. And, you know, the cop that pulled me over to the, you know, the shooter to the, you know, you name it, fill in the blank. And what I've come to realize in Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, I'm not the victim. I'm the issue, right? I'm the perpetrator. Yeah, absolutely, right? And so I grew up in Santee, born and raised San Diego. You know, had a pretty straight up mom and dad that, you know, stayed together till the day my dad died. And, you know, we went to church and never went hungry. And, you know, I had a pretty nice upbringing, but, you know, as I grew older, I started to recognize, you know, the stuff that I could get away with, you know. And as much as my parents really made an effort to instill in me those stand-up ethics, they started to slip, you know, when I found, you know, a little bit of alcohol and a little bit of drugs. And, you know, I became a changed person, the whole Jekyll and Hyde, right? And, you know, I was in Boy Scouts, and, you know, I learned all kinds of good life skills, like tying knots and how to, you know, make a yurt out in the middle of the wilderness. But when it came to going off to college, I didn't know squat. All I knew is I wanted to party. I wanted to be the cool guy. And I found that in a bottle. And pretty quickly it escalated, right? It went from, well, how about the first time I got drunk at 14, I got arrested, got a DUI, pretty sure I had full on alcohol poisoning, and my dad picked me up from the sheriff's station. And, I don't think my dad talked to me for like 3 days after that. I mean, the disappointment that he had for me, because, you know, as a parent, you never want to see your kids, you know, go down that path. And also understand, you know, my dad, he quit drinking. I'd say I was probably like 3 years old, 5 years old. Maybe I was 5 or 6, because I do remember him throwing back some beers. And, you know, one of the things I learned in drug and alcohol counseling is, you know, there's stages of alcoholism, right? And so the early stage, you're kind of partying, having fun, and you can kind of, you know, turn the switch off when you need to. And then it kind of progresses into, you know, kind of a more accelerated, you know, alcoholic stage where maybe you're, you know, more of a binge drinker or a problem drinker. And I learned that the allergy is actually able to be shut down if it's recognized soon enough, right? And so I've known a few people in my life that, you know, like their first DUI, they just quit drinking and that was it. And they lived their life, you know, fruitfully and never took another drink. And for me, I have multiple DUIs. I couldn't not drink and drive, you know, and anybody that, you know, knows what I'm talking about. I could not drink and drive. And when my drug and alcohol counselor looked at me and said, hey, I got a surefire secret that not a lot of people know about. I know the way you could never, ever get another DUI. And I'm sitting on the edge of my seat and I'm like, oh, what's this secret, you know? And he goes, you don't drink. And for alcoholics like me, you know, it's like, okay, cool story. Yeah, let's move on to the next. Let's talk about that. What is it? Moderated drinking, or, you know, how can I control and enjoy this, right? And this was after my second DUI, and my drug and alcohol counselor, I think he was in the rooms, and he took a page out of the big book, and he had everybody in our group, you know, pick a limit, right? And he really like kept it inviting, you know, what is it? What's that perfect spot? You know, is it 3 Coors Lights or is it half a handle? You know, where's that perfect spot where you got that good buzz and you're cruising and you're feeling good and you're talking to chicks and, you know, all that good stuff. And, all right. Now you're talking my language. And I think my limit was like, 8 Coors Light. It was like 6 or 8 Coors Lights or like 4 really strong pints, you know, either or. And he goes, okay, sounds good. That's your limit. And you're going to go out in the world and you're going to stick to that limit. And when you, you know, drink those 8 Coors Lights, you're going to stop. Sounds like a plan. So I came back, you know, a few meetings, you know, few weeks goes by. Oh man, it was so good. I only drank 5 and I was, you know, talking to chicks and I didn't drive and, you know, went home safe and I didn't black out or knock out any teeth and didn't end up in Mexico. Okay, cool. Good, you know. And he's just kind of sitting there nodding, you know. And then that one time the wheels came off. One more time I was pounding on the bar. How did this happen? Right. I went to a friend of mine's house party and, you know, a band came on and he was a brewmaster. So he had a whole bunch of home brews, but I made sure to bring my Coors Lights. And when all these people started showing up for the band, I started getting kind of freaked out. So I started stashing beers here and there, you know, totally normal, totally healthy. And because I didn't want to run out, right? Like, I was well drunk enough. I was beyond my limit. That limit was out the window. It didn't even pass my mind. And you know, I think I'm pretty sure I took a handful of drugs. I don't even know what they were. You know, somebody was like, oh cool, dude. What about me? Okay. And the next day, you know, I'm waking up with the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, that feeling in my gut that I was not myself, that what I was participating in was not a happy, joyous party with a band and with some friends. It was get as inebriated as I can and then keep going and make sure I have enough. And, you know, I talked to my friend the next day and he's like, what happened to you? And I go, oh man, I just got pretty drunk. You know, he's pretty drunk. He's like, I went to bed and there was a couple Coors Lights under my pillow. And then this morning there was a Coors Light in my medicine cabinet. And I'm like, dang, were they drank? And he's like, no. He's like, you're the only one drinking Coors Lights. And I was like, oh yeah. You know, you kind of start painting what happened the night before. And I started to recognize that I was hiding beers. And it was just like, this is not normal behavior. These feelings that I'm having right now, after, you know, spending time in jail, after letting down family members time and time again, was a feeling that I was so, it was normalized and I was so used to it. But this time it just sat different with me because I had some time with the drug and alcohol counselor. I had some days that I sat in meetings, and I'd like to say I tried to get, you know, sobriety through osmosis. I came to these meetings and, you know, oh, cool story, you know, okay, yeah. But when it comes down to that feeling that morning and recognizing that I didn't have an off switch and that it wasn't going to get any better, really accelerated my involvement in AA and my, you know, recognition that something needed to change. So I went ahead and quit the Coors Lights, but I still had some other stuff, you know, because it's Alcoholics Anonymous, right? The book doesn't talk about any other stuff. It's in the name, everybody. Come on now. And so, yeah, took some dirty tokens, and I recognized that, you know, one day I was working this menial warehouse job making minimum wage, and I could ride my bike there because I had lost my construction job because I couldn't drive the work truck. And I'm sitting in the parking lot, and everybody's sitting there, you know, drinking, talking. It's like 9 o'clock in the morning. It's our first break. And the boys are all drinking tall cans, and they're passing around some other stuff. And, you know, at this point, I hadn't drank in 8 or 9 months. And I had a whole bunch of friends in AA. And I was listening to everybody complaining about their life, talking about how we're going to get a raise, you know, how they're fighting with the welfare office, you know, about their kids, how their mom doesn't listen to them. And I'm talking full on adults. Like, these guys are like older than me, you know, and I'm sitting there going, okay. And everything's kind of clicking. And the homie was like, you want to hit this? And the first time in my life, God came down and put his hand on my shoulder and said, that is not for you. And it was a clear as day spiritual experience that these people had nothing that I wanted. And all the people that I had met in AA and went to barbecues and birthday parties and meetings and had cake and meeting before the meeting and pie at Denny's afterwards. And these people had homes and kids and bank accounts, you know, and I'm trying to figure out how I can, you know, make my DUI debt go away. Cause it just goes away, right? Like, after you just sit on it for a while, it just kind of fizzles out. You know, that whole, like, an ostrich that sticks their head in the sand? I literally thought that this kind of stuff would just go away. I'm like a 14-year-old trying to deal with life. And that recognition and that spiritual experience that I had in that parking lot was a undeniable interjection from God, from my higher power that, you know, painted a picture for me that I had to go back to those meetings and admit to those people that the tokens that I took were no good, that I was no good, that I was just a low-down, lying, cheat, drunk. Everything that I thought I was, I had to go admit it, right? And it wasn't until, you know, I put pen to paper and I wrote my fourth step, and my sponsor told me, you know, after I did my fifth step, my sponsor told me, you know, that stuff that you did does not make you who you are. You know, that's just stuff that you did. And if that's not who you want to be, you don't have to do that stuff anymore. You've got a God in your life. You've got newcomers that you can share the story with. You got a book. You got a car. Make it happen. You know, this is your life, right? And, you know, from there, as anybody who's had a spiritual experience and wrote their fourth step and did a fifth step with a sponsor, you know, I was rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, hands down. I was so frothing. I would be at the grocery store vibrating, just wanting to like tell people about AA, like, oh, even if you're not a drinker, you should work the 12 steps. They're pretty badass, dude. I'm telling you, like, it'll make you feel really good. When you're feeling really bad, it'll make you feel really good. You know, I just was, I was such a zealot. I was so fired up, and things in my life started unfolding that were beyond my expectations that I could even dream up. And, you know, I have some things scribbled down, that helped me to, remember, you know, some of those tangible miracles. I like to call them tangible miracles, you know, 'cause I would say, anybody that's agnostic, that sticks around the rooms and doesn't pick up, they feel the spirit of the universe. It is a undeniable cure for alcoholism. And it is an undeniable cure for that. I feel like a POS. I feel like a cheat. This is who I am. And just like my sponsor said it, I know every morning when I pray, God reminds me that that's not who I am, that I'm just another child of God, that I'm another man here on earth with a purpose. I can wake up every single morning, even if I don't have work to get to, even if I don't have, you know, bills to pay, even if I have anybody to call, I got somebody to call. I have a life purpose. And through that life purpose, you know, God just really works through, you know, human beings, right? It's right there in the seventh step prayer, right? And to recognize that I'm just a channel for God's love is such a peaceful feeling, right? And all the stuff that I did is in the past. And if I can pack things into the stream of life that are, you know, bringing light to the darkness, you know, I had a good day for sure. And so, you know, I've been able to sponsor guys, during, you know, COVID kind of kicked off. Right. And, the day before the lockdown, my dad passed, and, I'll talk more about that later, but I found, I think I had 7 or 8 years of sobriety, and I had I lived with my higher power. I don't know if anybody knows about that. She was pretty good for a while. And then the rug got pulled and I was going to maybe 1.5 meetings. You know, I'd say I'd log into a couple Zooms, but I'd pay attention about half the time. So I'd say 1.5 meetings. And, I was not a, spiritual, super stoked, fourth dimension of existence kind of guy at that point in my life. And I spent some time reflecting and it was a couple weeks before the lockdown, and I went to a meeting that I would never go to, being of service, met somebody that, you know, needed to hear the message. And I met a sponsee, the guy that became my sponsee at that meeting. You know, I always try to recognize that, you know, the meeting before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting quite often has a purpose, and it's not for me to just grab ass with my buddies. It's to welcome the newcomer and to, you know, just have that smile and seek out somebody that maybe looks like they don't feel like they're in the right spot, or maybe they're sitting real close to the exit and, they just need a handshake, you know, and a welcome. I'm glad you're here. Right. 'Cause how many people have you heard share, I will never forget the first man or woman that welcomed me in AA, you know? It might have been something as simple as the greeter at the door shook their hand and said, I'm glad you're here. And that person hadn't heard that, you know, for years. And that made an impact, right? These are the little things that I have no idea what that mustard seed's going to grow into. But if I am, you know, spiritually fit and I can go about my day and try to bring that light, I mean, I've seen, there was a woman that came into my fellowship and she was yellow with jaundice. And, I mean, she just looked like the walking dead. I mean, she was 1 foot in the grave and 1 foot out. And she was in her 20s. And I knew her from my neighborhood. And we'd actually kind of crossed paths a few times. And, you know, today she's, you know, living in Reno, owns a house. She's married. She has 3 kids. You know, these are the things that we get to witness, that I get to witness if I keep showing up, right? Walking, you know, my sponsees through the steps during the lockdown. I mean, we're sitting 6 feet apart and I got to check with my roommates to make sure it's okay. We sit on the patio outside and I gotta let my, roommates know that we're going to be safe, but the world's going to be a lot less safe if I don't do this, right? Like, this man needs my help. And it's not that I'm going to be doing anything. I'm just going to be sharing, you know, reading the book with them or working the steps with them. And, you know, as I watch my sponsees just thrive, you know, go from some pretty low lows to some really incredible places. So... you know, beyond my connection with my higher power, beyond, you know, work, beyond possessions, beyond my college degree, you know, I went back to college at 30 years old and got my degree. And I'm sitting there complaining to my sponsor about how I don't get paid enough. And, you know, I'm working too much hours and I'm sore. And he goes, yeah, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, you know, maybe ask for a raise or something. He's no. He said, you know, my parents put me through a few years of college. I was basically a senior dropout, you know, because it got so bad that I called my dad one day and he said, just come home, you know. And in the middle of the semester, I just came home, packed up all my stuff and left. And so my sponsor said, well, you know, you always talk about going back to school, right? And I go, oh yeah, but I think my credit's expired. And he goes, okay, well, you know what, cause it was quite a few years before. And he goes, well, what do you got to do to find out? And I said, oh, I heard they expire. It's gotta be, you know, they're no good. And he goes, well, why don't you make a phone call? And I go, okay. So I make a phone call and I meet with him the next week. So, did you call the school? Yeah, I called the school. Credit's never expired. Oh, good. All right, cool, man. Yeah, but I don't have any money. I got to keep working, dude. I'm still paying off debt. Okay, well, you know, there's the FAFSAs, right? Federal Assistance for College Students. Oh, yeah, but that was due in December. And, yeah, they already funded everybody. And he goes, well, why don't you just go online and apply? Okay. And, you know, dragging my feet, couple phone calls. Do you apply for FAFSAs yet? No. All right, get on the computer. So I apply for FAFSAs, and like 2 weeks later, I get a $5,000 check in the mail. And I call my sponsor. I go, I got a $5,000 check today. He's like, oh, bitching. Looks like you're going back to college. And I'm like, oh, shit. Sorry. And so, you know, here I am. Okay. Well, you know, I don't know what classes to take. Okay. We'll call your, so I go through and I set up my classes and I'm ready for school. And of course I'm enrolled in Cal State Fullerton and I live in Santee and it's about 2 hours away. And I'm meeting him on Saturday and I go, dude, I've been looking on Craigslist. There's just nonstop scams. Like, I cannot find somewhere to live. And he goes, well, I go, I don't know what I'm going to do, Bill. He said, well, I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to get in your car on Monday and you're going to go to classes. And I go, okay. And I said, what next? Because, you know, sometimes we need our hand to be held a little bit around here. And he goes, well, then you go to an AA meeting and you holler out to the fellowship and you let them know that you're here going to school and you could really use a couch to crash on. Okay, you know, sounds great. And meanwhile, I'm applying on Craigslist and I'm making phone calls and I'm going to AA meetings, making announcements. And there's this app called couchsurfer.com. And I'm getting a couple replies from, you know, some kind of, it's kind of one of those traveling networks, right? Where if you want to be kind of a hippie hobo floating around Europe for a few months, you like couch surf, just like the website says. And so I'm kind of getting that kind of vibe from these people. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if this is too conducive for my studies and my sobriety. And I get a message from a pastor, and this pastor is a professor at the Christian college across the street from Cal State Fullerton. And he goes, hey, you know, tell me a little about yourself. And I get him on the phone and I tell him kind of what I'm doing. And he said, well, I'm staying in a suite in the dorms, but it's like a big, you know, studio. And he said, you're welcome to, you know, stay, you know, for a few weeks or whatever while you're looking for a place to live. And okay, bitching, you know. And so we had some really good conversations, and he just really was a godsend, you know, when I was sleeping in my car in Orange County, you know. And so I'm going to AA meetings, and this gal comes up to me and she goes, hey, I got a friend from work, and he's buying a house and he's going to need to rent a room like right away, 'cause he does, you know, he can barely afford his mortgage. I'm bitching. I'm in. Right. And so I'm working it out with this guy. He's getting my social security number and do background check and all this stuff. And then that fell through. I don't know if it was something with his mortgage or something. And so I see her at a meeting a few days later. And this was, you know, while I'm staying at this, pastor at the Christian college. And she goes, how's it going? I'm just crushed, right? I'm right back to square one. And I'm telling you, the scams are crazy. Like, it gave me the heebie-jeebies, like, how, like, strange some of the, like, people trying to rent rooms. So she goes, oh, man, I'm sorry to hear that. She's like, maybe, you know, my husband, he's pretty plugged into, like, some men's meetings. I bet he knows somebody. Okay. She's like, why don't you come over on, you know, Friday or whatever, come have dinner and meet my husband. I go, okay. So I go over there and he goes, all right. Well, and we're just kind of standing in the kitchen. He's telling me a little bit about yourself. And I tell him my story, and you know, turns out he's an AA too. And I talk to this guy for 10 minutes and he pulls a key out of his pocket and he looks at me and he says, you can stay at my house for free as long as you need to, as long as you're still in school and you're staying sober. And I mean, I knew this guy for 10 minutes, right? And he's got this big, beautiful house, and he's got this whole wing that he built for one of his kids that lived there with him for a while. And here I am in Orange County that like rents even more than San Diego, and it's three blocks from the college, and I'm getting handed a key from a stranger. You know, you can't, this stuff doesn't happen to me, you know? And so I was able to stay with them. And, you know, I stayed there, I think a month, maybe a little longer than a month. And I found a really great place and rented a room from a nice guy, you know, a mile from school. And I rode my bike to school and it was bitching. And I treated college like my job. You know, I woke up every morning, I went to school, did what I needed to do, got some dinner, maybe watched a college baseball game, and went to a meeting. And, you know, for those two semesters, I have never been more at peace and feeling like that freedom that I've never, ever experienced since I was like, 5 years old on the swings, And I have four sisters and all of them are highly educated. And the day that I walked across that stage and got to, tip my hat to my dad and my mom was, just a testament to what it looks like when you just do this program one day at a time, right? And same thing with my contractor's license. I have a college degree, but I also have skills in construction. I was standing in front of a 7-Eleven cleaning pools with, 6 months sober. I was helping a friend clean pools, making $50 a day and getting off at noon. And this other guy I knew from the rooms was like, what you doing? It was like 5:30 in the morning. I got my lunchbox and I'm helping so-and-so clean pools. And he goes, all right, you ever do any construction? And I go, yeah, a little bit till I lost my license. And he goes, all right, well, sometimes I need an extra hand. And I bitching sounds good, And, worked for him for almost 8 years, And for at least a solid year, I would say, he picked me up every single morning. And we would read the 24 hours a day book. And we'd talk program. And we'd go to meetings together. And that man showed me so much beyond my construction skill set, right? His heart for sobriety and for ethics and for hard work are unmatched from any person that I've ever worked with. I mean, and then once COVID hit, I started doing quote unquote side jobs and I wasn't working for him anymore. And I had enough experience and I kind of did the same thing that I did with my college degree. I was having lunch with my pastor and he's going, how's your contractor's license application going? Oh, good. I'm called to school. I know their business hours and costs about this much. And you go, okay. So did you sign up for school yet? And I go, oh, not yet. He's like, okay, well, let me know and I'll talk to you, So he caught up with me and held me accountable and I signed up for school. And then the next time I was having lunch with him, he said, you sign up for the test yet? I go, oh, I'm still in school and I got to study. I got to make sure I don't fail because it costs an extra $100 if I fail. He goes, nope. What do you got to do to sign up? And I said, I think it's just you apply online. And he goes, okay, good. I'm waiting, And he sat there across the table from me and made me, sign up for the test, right? This is when I'm paralyzed with fear and for some reason I can't muster enough God power to get it done. God sends in some beautiful human being to help carry me, right? And if it wasn't for the people in my life, the people in the rooms, I would still be working a warehouse job or, digging ditches. Because that's what I was doing before I got sober. I mean, I was driving the work truck, but I was still digging ditches. My ability to show up for others and to be, who God wants me to be is a learned thing. Life didn't come with the owner's manual to tell me how to help others, right? And I get this sense that around the rooms, when it's life or death, right, there's a real priority to being available and saying yes, right? Because I see a lot of people in other fellowships that this isn't life or death for them. If they don't suit up and show up one day because they don't feel like it, their day goes just fine, right? And I have no idea what it would look like if I didn't suit up and show up and carry the message. It is not... I've witnessed so many miracles in these rooms that were so seemingly minuscule that I don't know who's going to die because I don't suit up and show up. right? That's how dire Alcoholics Anonymous is. That's how important my sobriety is, right? This is a seemingly selfish program, but you never know which guy you shake their hand and tell them welcome that's going to keep coming back just because your body was there to say hi. And that is a fact. And I got to recognize that, right? Because I'm rolling into double-digit sobriety. I'm feeling real good, right? And maybe I don't need to, you know, go to as many meetings. But what I recognize is it's not about me anymore. It wasn't about me after I took my 90-day token, right? And as I take new guys through the steps, my family grows. You know, my service outside of the rooms, right? I'm a mentor for teenage boys here in San Diego. And, you know, one of the men that I met early on is one of the co-founders of this nonprofit. And, you know, I don't have any kids myself. And I work for myself. And sometimes I can take a little bit of time. And I have this commitment at a middle school in Lakeside. And I show up every single Monday morning. And we're essentially holding AA meetings for middle schoolers. And we're not talking about, you know, necessarily drugs and alcohol, but we're talking about real life stuff that it took me until my 30s to realize there's a spiritual toolkit that can make my life just a little bit easier, right? And that, you know, that sitting in that chair week in, week out, I might not say one thing. You know, I got this one seventh grader. And I had never had a one-on-one conversation with this young man. And I went through the entire school year just being in the circle. You know, what we do is we listen, we encourage. You know, a lot of the program is what we don't do. We don't tell them what to do. We don't give them advice. We don't discipline them. They have enough of that in their life. And as I'm going through the school year, you know, we got a few of the young men that we take up to a ranch on Mount Palomar, and we have this retreat. And it's a coming-of-age retreat for these young men. And one of the exercises that we do is help identify the roadblocks in their life, right? And we go through this whole exercise. I mean, some of them take a couple hours. Right. And we're talking about what is preventing you from being the man that you want to be. And this young man that I'd never had a one-on-one conversation with picked me to represent the man that he wants to be. And then he shared, you know, a handful of qualities that I have that are things that he wants when he becomes a man. And so I'm standing on the other side of the room and we do this exercise. And he's just emotional the whole time. And when he gets to the other side of the room where I'm standing, he gives me a hug. And this kid embraced me for about, I mean, it felt like 2 minutes. And he just sobbed in my arms. And he said, thank you. Right? And all I could say was, thank you. You know? My service, my heart of service and my ability to recognize my life purpose to help other people is the most joyous, freeing, rewarding thing, right? That friend of mine that co-founded that program, he always talks about the gift of the giveaway, right? We come into the rooms, we get the gift of sobriety, we get a little bit of that elation, we get rid of some of the old baggage that didn't serve us. And that's when the real work starts, right? And it sounds like, you know, I had a buddy that called me one day early in sobriety. I'm driving a $900 Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme. My sponsor called it a newcomer car. It was a good one. It was a good one. And I go, hey, I tell my sponsor, I got a phone call and this old punk rock buddy of mine called me up and he said he can't get sober and he's miserable. And I said, do you know any good meetings up there in North County? And he goes, no, not, I don't really spend much time in Oceanside. And you know anybody that lives up there? I could give them their phone number. He goes, what are you talking about, man? I go, I don't know. I gotta give him somebody's phone number or something. You know, mail him a book. I don't know. And he goes, you know what you do, Jonathan? You get in your car and you bring your big book up there and you sit down with that man and you share what's been freely given to you. Yeah, but, oh, man, I haven't worked in weeks and my car is kind of, you know, running on five cylinders. And he just looked at me and shook his head. And he said, you think this is about money? He said, you will make more money. He said, you get in your car and you go up there and you meet your friend. You meet him right where he's at and you listen to him and you share a little bit of your story with him. And so sure enough, I drive up there, and I had some music playing too, but that was the car, smoking on the way up the 5 on fumes, right? I'm like, damn, why didn't I ask my sponsor for $20? And I don't know that anything miraculous happened that night, but what I do know is I gave away, I gave this man a little red book that was given to me by a man that died with 56 years sober, and he signed that book for me. And what I recognize in this program is there is no value in that book in my back pocket if I don't give it away, right? And, he took that book with him on a plane, and that friend of mine is still sober today. And he loved that it was a little pocket edition that he could read on the plane and nobody knew what he was reading. Right. And I still talk to that buddy of mine. I mean, he used to be a hardcore punk rock drummer and now he's a drummer at his church and he's got a couple kids and a house in Texas and he's just a beautiful man. And the crescendo of that story is, no joke, like 2 or 3 days later, my boy that I learned everything about constructing from called me up. He goes, are you ready? I go, I'm ready for what? And he's like, dude, it's coming down. And I did not have a day off for 6 weeks after that. Not one Sunday. I mean, I was working 12, 14, 16-hour days going from a residential home to downtown, building downtown until we collapsed at 3 a.m. for 6 weeks. You know, these are the things that, if I just do the next indicated step, it kind of shakes out, right? And people in the rooms always talk about that, right? They always talk about if I just do what's in the next indicated step, everything seems to work out, you know? But it doesn't always work out the way I like it to. But what I can tell you is that when I suit up and show up, and I listen to the men that I look up to in this program, and I do the next indicated step, I stay sober. And every time I show up, I get a little bit of my soul back, right? From those days that I was out there running and gunning and doing nobody a service. Something as simple, like I got these things that... Have just miracles that have happened in my life. Taking a new guy that was a chronic relapser, just going to In-N-Out one night, you know, I just saw the pain in his eyes and that guy's still sober today. And I mean, he'll stand there and take his cake and he'll talk about his sponsor and he'll talk about, you know, all the, you know, step work that he did. And then he always looks over and he goes, and then my boy Jonathan took me out to In-N-Out, you know, that silly hamburger and fries went so far for that chronic relapser to know that there is a solution. Right. And these are all just things that I recognize that I can move into as a vessel for God. A newcomer that came to my men's meeting, my home group, Soledad Men's, Saturday mornings, and he was visiting for, I think he was living here for a few months, and he said, I surf, and I'm not that good, but I'm looking for some buddies, so I got his number, and we went surfing a couple times, and I still talk to that friend of mine today, and he's a commercial pilot, and he was just a young punk kid trying to stay sober, couldn't stay sober. And I mean, he had me lead a Zoom speaker meeting in Utah one time, and I linked up with his sponsor after that speaker meeting, and his sponsor texts me a few years later, and he goes, "Hey, I got this guy that's in Utah right now in a rehab facility, but he's going to be moving back to San Diego for sober living. You got to meet this kid." I go, "Okay, whatever, you know, give him my number." And I didn't think anything of it. And a few weeks later, I met my men's group, and one of the fellows there that's got a bunch of time comes up to me, and he goes, "Hey, I got this kid that just got here from Utah. You got to meet this kid." And I go, "No." And I go, "Is his name so-and-so?" And he goes, "Yeah. How do you know?" And I go, "Oh, I got the word from some friends in Utah that he was coming out here," and he's just shaking his head going, "What?" And, you know, it's all these things that, like, God winks, right? Like, if I go through life and I'm just, like, going through knocking things over in the store, trying to get things my way, I don't see the sunlight of the Spirit. It's there, right? It carried me through some pretty you know, near-death experiences, but it's there. And it's not until I ask, you know, in those times of solitude for that sunlight of the Spirit to show, right? You know, every single person in this room right now is a beacon of hope for the newcomer, for, you know, that punk thief, you know, kid from Santee that walks in that just doesn't have any life skills and doesn't even know, you know, that this program does not advocate a little bit of something on the side. I mean, I was talking about when my dad passed, right? And some of my fellows showed up from AA. My sponsor showed up, and a couple other of my best friends in sobriety showed up in the hospital. And my dad was, he was walking the dog 3 days before he passed. The first day he was in the hospital, he was admitted, right? And we're visiting. The next day he was on a ventilator. The next day he was on life support. And then, you know, a day or two later, he was gone. And so this whole thing is unraveling. And my boy showed up at the hospital, and everything's hunky-dory because I'm putting on that face, right? I'm trying to be that spiritual good guy that's here, you know, going through it. "Thanks for coming, guys. Cried a little bit. I'm going to be okay." Back of my head's going, "Can you guys hurry up and leave? Because I'm about to bail. Like, this is way more than I signed up for." Like, I literally looked at my, I mean, we're sitting in the room with the doctor, and my mom's there, my sisters are there, and we're talking about what the options are. And I'm sitting there going, "Are you guys serious? You're talking about pulling the, what are the options?" Right? We're in a hospital. He's going to get better. Right? Who am I to play God? Who am I to expect that there's some miracle that the doctor's going to, you know, save his life and he's going to live another 10? How selfish of me, right? But that's where I was. And we're in the room, and I'm having this out-of-body experience. I mean, you know, in the movies when an employer's like screaming at the employee and the employee just cocks back and punches his boss, you know, or whatever, hits him with a chair. I'm in the hospital room having this out of body experience of like uprooting the hospital bed, smashing the window, throwing the doctor out, throwing my sister out that's talking about pulling the plug. Like, what is going on right now? And I'm just standing there. And my aunt saw, you know, the discomfort, and it was it was my aunt that you know, after we kind of finish up that, I didn't throw anybody out the window. Just paralyzed, right? The worst day of my life is right in front of my face, and we're talking about killing my dad, right? And I had thought about this day since I could remember. I mean, I had thought about that day since I was a little kid, what it was going to look like when I lost my dad. And I had this plan. I had a plan. It doesn't matter. But what happened is my aunt, you know, said, why don't you come downstairs? We'll get some fresh air. I'll talk to you a little bit. I said, okay. It's my dad's baby sister. And I mean, the way that she looked at my dad, I mean, he was her hero, hands down. And so she goes, you know, I was there when my mother-in-law passed. And I was able to be in the room and hold her hand when she passed. And it was impactful, right? I got to be there. I didn't want to be there, but I got to be there. And she kind of, you know, told me some of her story. And I decided to go back upstairs and you know, I just kind of got some fresh air and talked to my aunt and recognized that I needed to show up for my family, you know. And so we go up there and we're sitting in the hospital room and all my sisters are there. My mom's there. My aunt's there. And a couple of my sisters, like, got up to go get coffee. And we had been playing music and partying, and then it kind of unfolded into, like, we're super tired. We've been here for 3 days, and we're kind of bickering. And that all kind of fizzled out when a couple of my sisters left. And my mom's sitting at my dad's feet, and my big sister's sitting holding his right hand, and my other sister is holding his left hand. And I'm just kind of sitting there with my hand on his leg, and my mom, she's sleeping, and my big sister and I were kind of chit-chatting and just being in the moment. And my other sister fell asleep, and then my big sister fell asleep, and I'm just sitting there. And I kid you not, the moment that I closed my eyes, that moment when you just have that, my dad passed, and the, you know, machine made some noise, and about 45 seconds later, the nurse comes in, and she's kind of doing her thing, and the, like, seemingly most horrific catastrophe that I ever thought was going to happen in my life was the most beautiful moment I've ever been a part of. And I would have missed it, right? I would have missed it if I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do and just taking that first thought, you know, that thought of being selfish and I can't handle this to this is right where I'm supposed to be. And my dad knew we were all at peace. And he was a great man, and you know, these are the things that I get to experience in AA. I had a friend, Al, that used to say, you know, 99% of the catastrophes I survived never happened. I just keep suiting up and showing up, and, you know, the sunlight of the Spirit shows up every time. So I just want to let you guys know I appreciate your time very much. And, in the wonderful words of our good friend John B., I've never had it so good.
Thank you.